Hello, everybody. This is Coach Deanna, and I would like to welcome you. This is our very last week of our Engage 2013 Superpower Camp conference call. It has been an amazing amazing month, and we are completely blown away by everything that we've learned in this massive transformation that's happening in society and business. And, you know, at Coachable, we've always been the proponent of moving from the 20th century management philosophy, command, control, compliance, to 21st century coaching philosophy, which is engage, co-create, and play for results. And we gathered our tribe of bold champions of humanity flourishing, and this is our last week to spend time with them. So I'm thrilled that you're here. I'm excited that you consider yourself part of this team of world transformation. And I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Ana Maria Garcia Blanco. We had a really great call with her at the beginning of the Epic Tribal Gathering, and so I'm thrilled to have her back. She has an amazing superpower of social change, and she has done really remarkable things, starting with a single school in Puerto Rico and making significant change within that single school, and then having the ripple effect really impact the neighborhood and now the country, because other schools model what she does and they are changing everything. So I'm very excited to hear how she has engaged the community, the country, and the children. So Dr. Ana Maria Garcia Marquez, Blanco, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Gabriel Garcia Marquez because I have my book sitting here.
Thank you.
See, I equate you with magic. So
Garcia Marquez writes about surreal experiences, and our experiences are very close to that. Surrealism. So I am honored by the confession.
he's my favorite writer, and I'm just reading 100 Years of Solitude again. Because it's one of my favorite books, so I decided to choose it as summer reading. Excellent. Well, take it away.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. I am honored to be with you and with the people that are listening to us today, because I am honored to be part of this movement that I have learned through my coach that exists in different parts of the nation. I am thrilled to hear about people that are trying to make social change. I want to make the peace of the world where they stand a better place, a more just and peaceful place. So I am honored to be part of this conference call and this group of people that are thinking seriously about how they can make the world a better place, starting from where the place they are from. So thank you. Today, the presentation that I will share with you, I have organized in three main parts. At the beginning, I'll do a short introduction of what is social change for us, and what has been this incredible experience, this privilege of being part of a history of a social change, a concrete social change experience. Then I will present one of the main tools that has been very important for us in our work. Why that tool? What are the elements? What are the principles behind them? Behind that tool, what is the methodology? What are the rules of the methodology of the piece? And then at the end, I would like to present a challenge to the listeners, to the people that are participating, in terms of how can they, or a concrete experience that they can use in their context. So if we're ready, I'll start. For us, social change is a concrete experience resulting from tangible, concrete actions. Many times when we read in books and talk about social change, people think about you know, this huge movement or this very abstract concept. I think of very concrete things, of concrete experience, of concrete people. Of it implies a change in the way people see the world, in the world, in the way they see each other, and the way they see their relationships. Generally, it denotes a variation in behavior towards other people and the world, and the manner we see ourselves, personally and collectively, and our capacity to transform things. So it's a change in vision that will take us to a change in behavior. For me, that's the basic element of a social change. If we want change, like I think we all want, for a more just and peaceful society, we have to do things differently. I recall a quote by Einstein. Einstein once said that crazy people are not the ones that do things differently. Crazy people are the ones that do things in the same way once and again, expecting different results. Many times people that are engaged in the kind of work you do and the kind of work I do, they look at us and say, oh, you crazy people. But I agree with Einstein. Crazy people are the ones that do the same thing all over and are talking about changes that never come. I have a privilege in my life to be part of a history of a small barrio in Guaynabo, Puerto Rico. It's called Juan Domingo, and in 1987, a group of community members of this small inner city barrio met and decided to stop the circle of failure that was their school, their public school. Why do I call it a circle of failure? 40% of the children of the barrio never reached ninth grade. A high percentage of them ended up in gangs and drugs. School teachers lacked motivation and support from the school community. There was a lack of basic resources and school materials. High percentage of the children failed at least once while in elementary school. The school's gates were always closed to the community. Parents were called in just to hear about the problems their children were causing. In 1987, this school closed down because, according to the Department of Education's officials, there were not enough children and young people in the community of Juan Domingo. The community reaction was not expected by the government officials. The community organized action for social change. They rescued their school and transformed it for its youth. So it was a very concrete act of taking control of a situation that was hurting the community and their next generation, and transformed that situation into a possibility, into a new school. Are you there with me? Do you listen to me? Hello?
We are all,
we're here.
Oh, yes, I said I lost you. Everybody was so silent.
We're being quiet because you're so great.
You were just writing down everything you're saying.
Okay, all of a sudden I felt alone in the world.
No, we are with you.
I'm glad you're there. So what were the tools we used for organizing the community? What tools did we use then that have served us through our 25 years of history? And now, 25 years later, we can say has brought change, concrete social change, to our barrio and to other 20 communities in the island of Puerto Rico. We looked at one special tool, a basic tool that is constant through the history. In Spanish, we call it mesas redondas, round tables. These stand out as an essential tool in our work. This is going to be the topic of my presentation today and the topic of the exercise I will have you do during the next month. Why the round table? The tools we used to organize the community had to meet certain requirements, and in a sense, they were completely opposite to the structure and experience the community was undergoing. Those tools had to be opposite to what we were experiencing. The parents had been mistreated, the school system officials had misused their authority. They were profoundly authoritarian. Parents had been kept out for years of the decisions that affected their children's education. And I should say that also teachers were kept out of the decisions that affected their work. As a result, the community was hurt, and there was a total lack of confidence between the school and the community. So the tools we were about to use had to be opposite, and had to bring opposite elements from the ones present in that social situation. They had to be participative, they had to be democratic, they had to be in themselves a community-building experience. They had to be an experience of justice and of peace. This had to meet four elements or criteria. They had to reconstruct a social tissue that had been broken. They had to bring back confidence in themselves and each other and about the possibility of change. They had to get people to work together, collaborate with each other in the construction of concrete alternatives, have people co-creating. And they had to be efficient in getting an immediate result. We had to reopen the school that had been closed down by the government. The people that work out there, and many of you who are listening to me, know what happens in a group of people when they are under these circumstances that I had just described. Usually people start fighting each other, blaming each other, are very hopeless. So the exercise of getting to our goal, which was to open the school, had to be an exercise that would reconstruct our community. Because if we did not do that, we will never get to our goal, which was to reopen the school, but to reopen a school that was going to be a new school. We didn't want to reproduce the school that had kept us out. So I want to emphasize that that exercise in itself has to be a community building, has to be an exercise that reconstructs the social tissue that has been broken by these realities that we are going through. So we have established that the roundtable was our main tool and why we chose it. We chose it to heal at the same time we were doing work, efficient work. Usually efficient work is a way of healing, which is very interesting to me. So what are the principles of this roundtable? In the roundtable, there are three actions that are very important: dialogue, praxis, and reflection. What are the principles behind these actions? I would like to mention seven. All people are equal and have the identical right to participate and contribute. All people have important ideas to share and deserve to be heard. And that's what we call the basis of a dialogue. You have an idea that you deserve that we listen to. It's an important idea. Every idea is important. All people deserve to be treated with respect. Number four, concrete changes come from people's different ideas. So we consider differences as a plus and not as a problem, which usually they look at difference as a problem. For us, differences do not divide us. They unite us. They help us get to a better solution. Number five, change comes from people's capacity to work together. Dialogue and reflect upon their actions. Dialogue and introspection. Dialogue, action, introspection. That's where the change comes. All people have the responsibility to share their ideas and to contribute actions toward the fulfillment of those proposals. So you have the right to be heard, but you also have the responsibility to grow and to be part and to share and to be active. And number seven, we believe that social change emerges from community building experiences where people develop strong relationships with each other, with their community and with their goal or their dream. So those are the principles that we have to look for when we look at our tool of the round table. So we construct the methodology that emerges from these principles. And what is that methodology? It's very simple. We meet regularly. People have to meet. It depends on the situation. At the beginning of our history, we met many times in 1 week. Later on, we started meeting once a week, or twice a month, or once a month. But we have to meet regularly, and people start waiting for that meeting. Second, we rotate the person who conducts the meeting. And we decide who is going to conduct the meeting next time at the end of each meeting, so that people share the responsibility of leading a session. All the meetings have an agenda. Members of the group participate in the definition of the agenda. The agenda has to be established before the meeting and sent to everyone in the table. And there's a time set for each item in the agenda. And sometimes people think that we're very close with this methodology, but behind the methodology of a shared agenda and timekeeping is a message of respect. We respect people's time very much. Usually parents are brought into to meetings that have no agenda, that they don't know where the agenda is going, they don't know how long the meeting is going to be. So we are trying to rescue a methodology, a structure where people feel secure, they know why they're there, they know what they're going to be talking about, and they know when it starts and when it finishes. And all those are symptoms of respect. All agendas have the following parts. We start out with a meditation or a small reading that establishes and sets the tone of a peaceful atmosphere. We all come from very hectic realities, lives, the street, the car jam, you know, jobs or no jobs. So we come, when we get together, we always start with a meditation or a reading or a listening to a music that will bring peace atmosphere to the meeting. Reading of the agenda and agreeing about what everyone expects from the meeting. So we read the agenda and we are all accepting that that's going to be the agenda for that day. Number three, we make sure that every topic receives an adequate attention. And the leader of the meeting sets time for each topic, making sure that each topic gets the attention it needs. And that's very important for efficiency, for getting our job done. At the end of the meeting, we always have two small parts that we call the evaluation of the meeting. And this is a very important piece of our work. Participants evaluate the dynamics of the meeting. We don't go back to the issues in the agenda. We evaluate how we're working together. How did it go? Did we get our work done? Did we follow the rules of peaceful teamwork and collective work? Did everyone treat each other well? And what can we do next time to be more efficient and to be true to our principles of peaceful teamwork? And we always encourage people to appreciate each other for what they're doing, either the jobs, the work that they're doing for the group, or to appreciate the participation they had in that particular meeting that contributes to the goal of our dream. And then we establish the next date and time and issues to be discussed and work upon, and will be leading and who will be leading the meeting. So let me just mention briefly the parts of our meetings, which each one of them has a very important purpose. Meditation or small reading of the agenda, the issues of the agenda, evaluation of the meeting, where people evaluate the way they work together and where they appreciate each other for the work they're doing. At the end of the meeting, it's very important that we review specific task that people have for the next meeting. We'll make sure that people take note in that part of the meeting. And also we take with us those issues that will entail collective decisions so that people have time to think about them before they come back to the round table. Those are the parts of the agenda of the round table. Now let me mention briefly the rules of peaceful teamwork for that round table that I've been talking about. These are also very simple and very human. One person speaks at a time. Everyone listens to the person that is talking. No cell phones, no talking to each other, no interruptions. Everyone has a turn to talk, and the leader gives turns, so he or he makes sure that no one speaks too much and others don't speak. Participants get a chance to talk, and they get a second chance to talk after everyone has the opportunity to raise their issue or to answer questions when they have to clarify a question, you know, an issue. All these talk about the dignity of the person, you know. When you talk, it's important that you listen to that person. Decisions are made by consensus, not by voting. Participants have to come to an agreement together. And the process of coming to an agreement is a concrete way of constructing community, of building community. People start thinking collectively. We know that not always the majority will bring the best solution. Having a vote stops the group from thinking together and reaching many times the best alternatives. Usually voting divides people. Who's against, who's pro? The issue is not who's against and who won the election. The issue is, are we coming to the right decision? Participants are encouraged to work towards and consider the common good, and that's a very important element in our work. When we make a decision, we have to think of the collective and of the community. Is this the best solution for everyone, not only for me as an individual, but for the collective? Participants are encouraged to appreciate each other and their work. Many times we criticize the work of people. We encourage and we practice appreciation. The participants reflect upon their behavior as part of their work. And that's a very important issue. If we go back to the introduction, when we talk about social change, and that it implies a change in behavior. So we work, it's like a gym, it's like an exercise where you become a better person. The meetings are confidential and people keep what happens in the meeting to themselves. Decisions and ideas are shared with the community at large, but the process of the discussion and possible differences is kept, and that's a very important exercise also. Participants tell each other with respect what they're thinking, and no one can talk in the back of the other person. That is one of the most violent things that happens in groups. So gossip in the group is strictly prohibited. And if it happens, it has to come to the table, and we have to work together so that we never, our behavior never hurts the community experience. So those are the rules by which we call it reglas de convivencia, sana convivencia, rules of peaceful teamwork, are essential elements of this social change movement. People learn, change their behavior to be able to work for a common good. They come together, they think together. When people come together and think together, solutions emerge, and then we have an action. In our experience, what emerged in those tables was a new school for a barrio that had a terrible school for years and now has a good school. So that's a concrete action, that's a concrete idea that comes from uh, from from a collective exercise of community building. So, are you ready for the challenge?
Yes. What is it? Let's hear about this challenge.
So, this is a challenge for you people who are listening to me. During the next 3 months, from August to October, I invite you to build your roundtable tool in your organization, in your community group, in your team, and develop with that roundtable the plan, the action plan for this year, 2013-2014, and that exercise of developing a plan of action be in itself a community building experience that itself starts to bring social change. And I have suggested course of action. I will start in August with a long meeting. It could be a day or a half day workshop. Sometimes when we start in new schools and not sometimes, we do this once a year, we try to go away to the countryside or to a different place where we have what we call a retreat or a long meeting. And in that workshop or in that day or half a day workshop, the topic will be the construction of the collective, the construction of that round table. And the agenda for that day, I suggest, will be to greet the participants and start with a meditation or a reading that will bring peace to your group. Second, I will present the agenda. And the agenda for that day is not the plan of action of your team, but it's the importance of the community building experience that their work entails. I will present the methodology you will use for the day. And we'll carry two group dynamics. The first one, I would call it the rules of peaceful teamwork, and I would ask the group of people to develop their own creed, their own code of honor. I would have participants think how they would like to be treated in their groups and how they are willing to treat each other. And I will give them a solo time so that they can think about that. How do I want to be treated in this group, in this community group, in this organization? And then I will have them share with two or three participants in the group, so I will get people talking in small groups about how they want to be treated and how are they willing to treat each other. So they're talking about behavior and how it affects each other. Third, I will come together to a plenary session and share the ideas with each other. And from that session, I will start constructing an honor code by which we are going to act. It's the rules by which our relationships are going to stand. The second dynamic will be why. Once we establish the rules by which we're going to behave or how we're going to treat each other, then we talk about why we're here, what is our dream, what do we want to change. And that's very important when a group of people can define together what is your dream, and that dream will be present throughout their lives as an organization. What is it that we want to change? What are the elements of that change? Have participants work in small groups to answer these questions and again come together and again as a group, as a big group, define the dream that brings you together. So in the first two parts of the meeting, you have set the code of honor, the rules of behavior, and you have put in the table or put in the on the walls the dream, that the horizon where you what towards what are you walking. The third dynamic will be then to start thinking about the plan of action. How do we take that dream into a plan of action, into concrete steps? When are we meeting? How are we going to work together? Who will be responsible for that? And I know that many of you, probably you've done this millions of times as part of your organizations. What I am inviting you to do is to, before making the plan of action, construct or bring an exercise, a community building exercise that will make the third dynamic, the one, the plan of action, a more deep exercise. At the end of the day, I will evaluate the day of work, and I will use the tool of evaluation that I mentioned earlier in this part of the roundtable meetings, where everyone in the room, no matter how large the room is, has the time, has the opportunity to evaluate what happened during the day in terms of how people relate to each other, how they related to the agenda, did we do what we came here to do, and how did our behavior contribute to that or did not contribute. So nobody should leave the room that day without being able to express how they felt during the day and to evaluate the work. Usually what we do is we ask a volunteer, and once that volunteer evaluates, we go around the table and recognize everyone, each of them. Even if some people say at that point, I don't want to say anything, but they are recognized as an important piece of that round table. So that will be my first meeting in August. Or the first meeting when you come back together to your organization. Then from August to October, you could think about 6 meetings, follow the methodology established today, follow the honor code that your group established in that retreat or first long meeting, follow the plan that your group establishes, use the meeting methodology that strengthens your collective. Look at your plan. How is it going? What have you accomplished in this month? Look at your group. How are you working? How are people feeling about the work, about their joint effort? How do they feel about being part of your team? And then by October, you could think about 2 things. What is the relationship between the way people are relating to each other, are behaving with each other, and the accomplishments of your team? If you change the methodology of how people relate to each other and how they relate to the dream and how they relate to the work, what effects does that have in your team? What is the relationship between the principles that constitute your dreams and the methodology you are using to bring people together? What is the relationship between your dream, between the principles that hold your dream, between the principles of that change you want to bring, and the methodology you're using to work? Do they contradict each other? Do they complement each other? Do they help each other? Are they true to your principles? We're asking for more democratic, for more just society. Are we being democratic? Are we being just? Are we being able to deal with differences, with different personalities, with different faiths, with differences? What is the relationship between my methodology and my dream? And I think their lives, in the answer to those questions, lies the agenda for your organization in terms of social change. And I'll see you in October, I think. Wow. Thank you.
Wow, it's awesome.
I have a zillion pages of notes.
Yeah, I have a bunch of notes here too. I like it. It's really, really good. All right. Dr. Anna, could you, we want to open up and give folks a chance to ask questions. Anyone who would like to ask a question or share an insight from what Dr. Anna is sharing. So we want to include anyone who wants to participate. So if you want to ask a question or share something, please raise your hand. You can press a 1 on the keypad of your phone. If you would like to jump in and share something or ask something. Dr. Anna, I would like to ask you a question maybe you could share, because it's a really beautiful methodology that you've shared and a really concrete plan. Maybe you could share two things. One is, what is some of the, or maybe a success story that you have using this method? How did it, what did you use it for, and what were the results? And maybe you could also share some of the challenges that you faced in having people participate in a rigorous method this way.
Okay, sure. Success stories, I could mention many success stories that come with us, you know, large success stories, like maybe what brings me to you in terms of how the biggest success story was the rescue of the school, and, you know, from a very bad school to a very good school. There are no dropouts, no drugs problems in the school. Our children are going into the best high schools, and many of them are starting to go to the universities in Puerto Rico, and some are going out of the island now to some of the universities in the States and in Spain. So that's a success collective story. One story that comes to my mind very early on our history was when we opened the school. The first thing, and it has to do with the challenges, we reopened the school. We are the school community, and we think that we are loved by everyone. And the first day we were working already within the school building, we had these young people throwing, you know, rocks at us. So I come out of the school building, and I greeted the people that were throwing rocks. And it's interesting, I had my first round table with them that day. They didn't want to come into the school, so we did it outside in the street. We sat down and talked. And we started listening to their stories and how angry they were. They were part of the dropout rate groups, you know. So that group, it took me some weeks before they trusted us. And eventually they came into the building, and eventually we created a program with them that is called I Learn By Doing. And I wish they would work in different places in the community during the morning and then come in the afternoon to study and graduated from high school. And it's interesting, some of those kids are now teachers and are now people that work in the community and contribute to our school. So for me, that was a very successful story, how you turned what the society calls a dropout student into a staff member of the school, and through that, how they became, you know, how they reached the high school diploma and university's diploma, etc. So that for me was a very successful story. Mm-hmm. We have many stories. One of them that really helps me, one of the places where we work at is a housing project that has been very, very invaded by the drug world. So it's very violent, and people are very scared to go into this huge housing project. More than 30,000 people live there. And it's interesting how we started a house of children, a very small classroom in Montessori house of children, and we started organizing the parents around the children. And it's interesting how 3 years later, you know, the community will not allow violence around the school. So we have a sector within this housing project that, you know, violence stopped. And then that had an effect on the rest of the housing project, and we have had months of peace in the housing project. And I think it's great that it came from a very small group of children and parents looking at them in a different way, parents sitting around a table in a different way than what they were used to. So those are success stories that, you know, really make us very hopeful And sometimes people think, you know, every time, well, many times when we sit down with government officials or work with Department of Education, they think that change takes years and years. And once you change the equation, you start seeing very important changes and very immediate changes, which is very interesting. So for me, those are very important stories. You have also life histories, which are very touching for me. I'm just thinking about a child that came to me when he was 4 years old. He was at the House of Children, our first Montessori House of Children. And he came to me and he said that he wanted a meeting with me. I was a school principal then. So I opened the door. I said, I have you here. Let's have the meeting. And he said to me, Anna, I was born to play the violin. So I looked, you know, this is a very low budget school.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have enough money to buy, you know, paper for the bathrooms, you know. So, and I'm looking at this beautiful angel looking at me saying, do something about it, you know, grow up. So I started talking to him, and we organized a group of children, and we started the first Suzuki violin group in our school, and now it has grown into a larger group. Now we have many things have come out from that, and you know, hundreds of children have benefited from that child that came to us and said, I have a dream. So, and now I'm so happy to say that he graduated, he got a scholarship at a Jesuit high school, a prep school, which had never been available for public school students. And he got into Berklee School of Music in Boston with a full scholarship.
Wow.
So for us, that's a success story, but also a symbolic story, because what I get from the schools where this child went to after us, when they come back to us, they say, you know, the good thing about this guy is not only that he is a good student, an excellent student, but that he's a good person and that he builds community wherever he goes. So for us, it's very, you know, it's a success story, not only because he got into a great school, a very, very, you know, excellent school, but the way that he deals with his privileges, how he comes back to us every summer and volunteers in the school and identifies students that want to be musicians, and he has a band, and then his band raises money for the school. So he's a person that will make the world a better place. So it's not an individual achievement only, but it's a collective achievement. So for us, that's a success story that is very touching, is very symbolic of what we're talking about.
Yes. That's awesome. Wow, Dr. Anna, you are truly an amazing human. Thank you for being amazing. Let's hear from some of our folks who want to share, starting off with the amazing Tina Custodio.
Hey, everybody. I'm in a parking lot, so if people hear weird noises, I apologize. I'm in a parking lot about two blocks from Anna's original school. I have the privilege and the honor of knowing Anna pretty well, and she's being very modest. So I will be immodest for her. It's one of the things we all love about her, but I'll be immodest because she can't be. She uses this round table methodology not only in her school, but in every interaction she has, and she has interactions with the top business leaders. She has interactions with the top government officials, and she uses this methodology in all of them. And it's amazing how it changes the culture of even the slightest conversation, and it makes ambassadors for her movement out of absolutely anybody. And my question for her that I would like her to expand upon is, how does she bring, let's use the word very assertive people, and you know what I'm trying to say with that sentence. How does she bring them into the round tables, and how does she make sure that the round table culture is not squashed by very assertive people?
That's a question for me?
That is a question,
yeah.
Yes. It's challenging you.
I didn't listen to the name of the person that is in the parking lot.
Anna, it's Christina.
It's Christina.
Oh. Hola, Cristina.
Hola.
Where are you? Thank you, Cristina. Well, Cristina was my coach, and she, you know, she is a very important part of this history. How do I bring people? You know what, Cristina? I think that I should, you know, maybe people are expecting a very academic answer. You know, I think I learned this with my mother. My mother used to say that people behave the way they do because they're permitted to do so. So I believe a lot in the culture that permits or not permits a behavior. So we're very tercos. How do you say tercos? I'm very convinced that when you set the tone of a meeting, when you set the culture of a meeting, that will educate many people that in other meetings will not behave. It reminds me of, Christina's mentioning, I do have meetings with many people. Sometimes I have business people with teachers in a table, and I have very strong leaders of their companies, usually they're, you know, the head of the company. So yes, sometimes I have very strong characters on the table, and how the methodology of the meeting helps you communicate to the people that there's a behavior that is not permitted. And when people behave in the way they should not, you just intervene in a very peaceful way. You know, you follow the rules, but you do not permit that behavior. And I'm not being... you know, this is a behavior, when I talk about the behavior, I cannot permit a behavior that hurts anybody in the table. I cannot permit a behavior that will make a difference between the dignity of people. Everybody has the same dignity around the table. So that's very important, usually, especially at the first meeting where you set the tone and that you set the rules. People learn very early on what is allowed and what is not allowed to do in a setting. And that's something you see in children so well, you know. Children know exactly what is permitted and what is not. With adults, sometimes it's a little bit different. It's a little bit harder. But, and also, Christina, the tool of the evaluation is essential, because at that time in the meeting where you relax and where you put the issues outside of the table, and you talk about the behavior of the group, you have to be very honest so you can be efficient with these people that are not used to listening to each other, or people that are on the phone while you're talking, you know, things like that. So it's an exercise, it's like a gym. But I find it very efficient. And the other thing, Christina, which is, and I think you and I have talked about that, I learned this with the children also, is that you come to the table with profound faith that it's going to work, and that, you know, your faith is there. And I look at people with the faith that they're going to behave well, and 99% of the time it works.
Absolutely.
Positive expectation. We like that, and I also like the way you just said that. Doing your round tables is like playing a game. So I think that is very good, because we love that at Coachville. we think everything can be played a game, especially when everyone learns how to play fairly. So that is good. Awesome. Thank you, Christina. Thank you for acknowledging the amazing Dr. Anna, and we're so thrilled to have Christina on our staff as one of our instructors. So it's beautiful that you are her coach and you brought Dr. Anna to this Engage 2013 gathering. So we're really grateful to both of you. We have someone from 281 area code. Who is this?
Yeah, I think that's me. This is Ted Eisensee.
Hey, Ted.
Hey, how you doing, Dave?
Great to hear your voice.
Yes, I have a question. I've used a lot of the techniques you talked about, and they work very well. One of the things I haven't tried so much is not doing voting and just relying on the consensus decision-making. So I was wondering how that's worked out, and specifically, has that been a challenge for you, you know, not to ever put things to a vote?
Yes. For us, it has been essential. What's your name?
Ted.
Ted
Eisens. Yeah.
Ted. For us, it has been an essential tool, and I think I don't recall well how we got to that decision, but I remember very early on thinking that by voting we were dividing people and not uniting people, so that we had to change that voting thing. And then we came to the consensus exercise, and it has made the difference in our history. People, when we, you know, in the communities where we work at, people are very divided by many things. When people are suffering and people are outside of the structures and are not considered, people develop a lot of mechanisms, you know, that keeps them apart. So one of the things that we had to do is take those walls down. And so we have to look at the tools that divide people. At the beginning, for example, you come into a community and people are saying, well, I'm against this teacher or pro this teacher, or I'm against this method or pro this method. So you have to go, you have to take those walls down and start talking about the big questions, the big issues, the issues that will bring people together. And then you start making decisions from those big principles. So many times, instead of voting, you know, what really takes you to a good solution is have people think and make arguments and talk to each other. And, you know, in that discussion is much more efficient and rich than by voting, you know. I remember talking about uniforms in the schools and people proposing that we voted on them. And uniforms are not uniforms, and I'm using a very concrete, simple example. Usually the issues are more complicated. But the discussion was so rich in terms of what the uniform meant for some people, or why, you know, why the reasons behind a decision. So the alternative was a third solution, you know. We find through the history of our work that, yes, that consensus brings people together and oblige people to listen to each other. Because when we leave the room, we have a consensus. It's not a voting where some people win and some people lose, and, well, you know, my idea did not win, so I'm not that engaged. Everybody is engaged in consensus because everybody's part of that, of that decision. And we cannot act upon things until we have consensus. So it's a deeper exercise, and it's a community building activity versus a community divisor. So yes, it's been essential for our work, Ted.
Oh, that's great. It would be good to know more. Maybe you don't have time to do it right now. Like the details of how, you know, of that exercise or that model, because I think that's very important.
It's very simple, Ted. It's you. For example, you bring an issue, and then you have you're very disciplined in terms of having everybody participate and make suggestions. If you set a culture of respect for differences, and also you know, a feeling of that we all have to come to the common good, to what's good for everyone, people will give their best in a discussion, and they will be brave, and they will share ideas, you know. So then you have so many times what we do is we write, you know, in a board or in a piece of thick papers the different alternatives, and we discuss them, and we challenge the group. We have to choose one. We have to convince each other. And we're not going to vote. We don't even talk about voting anymore. So so we go around and around and around, and what happens if you have everybody participate and nobody dominating the discussion, you know, everybody has the same amount of chances, usually we have the group create arguments. You know, what is the argument behind this idea? So you have people thinking about it and questioning, and then you invite the group to start, you know, reaching a common solution. So it's like going deeper and deeper and deeper into the topic, and then, you know, committing yourself to a common answer. And then you review that consensus, and then you have to make sure everybody is in agreement. And once you have that, then everybody commits to that. You know, everybody is loyal to that consensus.
Great. Wow. Well, thank you very much.
That's amazing. Ted, that's a great question. Thank you for bringing that out. I didn't catch the depth of that part of the method until you asked that question, so that was very helpful. Thank you for contributing that. We have just a few minutes left, and wow, this has been such an amazing conversation. We have a few more people who want to share something, so let's just get their thoughts on the table, and we'll see if we can do them now or find some other way of addressing them. So, Patricia, please share your thought that you wanted to add to the conversation.
Yeah, I thought this was a fantastic presentation, and so very, very generous also to share her thoughts and ideas. We have a culture of consensus in Sweden, in Swedish companies. Unfortunately, the culture also says that when we leave the room, we start discussing whether we're really going to follow it or not. So it's not the consensus that you're getting. And I would love to know, but I do realize the time isn't good for this, how you stop that sort of after discussion. My question is, though, if one wanted to start, because I really would love to be part of the group that you're going to put together. However, I won't be having a community to work with until probably January, maybe with a bit of luck sometime in September, but it looks as though it would be more in January. Would it be possible to be part of your group if you don't have a real project to work with?
I am not sure I understood your... You asked me two questions, right? One question about what do I do with people that come out of meetings and do things against the consensus? Is that what you're asking me?
They say
they're in consensus, but then they don't. But then they don't act because they didn't really agree. So that's sort of a practical issue of how to handle that. But just to answer your second question, Patricia, we're going to change the model a little bit about how we're doing this going forward. So we were going to do a 100-day thing that was going to start and end, but now we're going to change the model to kind of a monthly membership. So you will be able to choose when you want to take on this social change initiative at whenever it makes sense for you to do it. So anyone who's ready to start now can start now, and folks who want to start in September can start in September or January. We're going to make this like a year-long thing that you can take on any of these engage superpowers at any month that makes sense for you to do it. So you'll have plenty of opportunity to join in.
That's fantastic. Great. Thank you.
Okay. If you want, I can answer your question.
Please.
Dave, do we have time for that?
Yeah, please, go for it.
Okay, yes, because it's a very important question, and it's something that happens especially, it happens, you know, it's part of the life of groups. And what the way we think about it is that first, once you're part of an organization or a team or a group or a company, especially, and I think that what brings us all together today is that we are, our groups, our companies, our teams are committed to a social change, are committed to a human change, are committed to finding different ways of doing things. So we cannot think that because we did the round table and used the methodology, in 2 or 3 weeks we're going to have a big change in people. This is a long-term run. You know, when we come into a community and we start doing this, we believe in the methodology, so we do it very with much discipline. But we know that it's going to take, in some communities, it can take years before we can heal and before we can learn how to behave in the way that we should behave if we have the dream that we have. Okay, so if I'm committed to this social change, or this dream, I have to be committed to the principles of that dream. So what we do is we take a lot of care in terms of relationships and in terms of how people deal with information, how people deal with the work of each other. So we usually have like in the different communities like a core group that meets more than the round table, that meets more and that takes care of the culture of the place, that takes care of the relationships, that can intervene both individually or collectively when things are not going well. For example, when I was a school principal, we had a meeting and we had consensus that we were going to do such and such a thing. And then, like, you know, Monday came and then people started, you know, some of the people of the group will resist or will not do what the consensus said we were going to do. So immediately there's a call. You know, we have to come back to the table either collectively or individually, and you as the leader have to be very sensitive to what your group needs. So many times I would call that, I'm going to have coffee with you. So I will bring in people to my table to talk about to bring to consciousness what they were doing and how it was affecting the collective and how it's affecting the goal of the group. And it's an invitation to think, why am I here? And if I am here and I am part of this, I should behave in this certain way. So you have a lot of work to do individually, you know, with people that helps you then when they come back to the round table. And then again, when the round table has a very good effect on people in terms of many times it's not the leader or the principal or the director of the program who has to bring up ideas about, you know, issues about behavior or not respecting the code of honor. And the same group educates, you know, its members. You know, people start not permitting certain behavior that are destructive, can destroy, you know, your goal and your dream. And you know what is fantastic is to watch the young people and the children do this in their classroom. You know, we run the classrooms in the same way. We have the community building experience, the round table, we build the experience of the classroom in the same way that we build the staff and the faculty and the community organization. And it's great to see how the young people and the children deal with that, you know, and bring consciousness to others how they're affecting the common good. So that exercise is, you know, many times when I meet with a school principal, they think, you know, they come back after their third meeting where they have used the methodology, and they come frustrated, oh, Anna, but they're still doing gossips and they don't do it. And I say, you know, this is a long term. Children learn much faster and are much closer to the truth and to the way that we should behave. But the adults, we have a lot of years there. We have a lot of things to heal. It takes longer. But it's, I believe very strongly you know, what Christina was saying before, and it's something maybe Christina helped me look at because I was not aware of how strong it was, is how when you construct, when you set the tone, when you create a culture, how people come into your place and behave in a different way. People come into the institute and they don't scream, they don't talk out loud, they don't use cell phones. And, you know, I never have to tell people that when they come in. You know what I'm saying? So the culture, but also that individual work of the leader with its members in a very caring table where you bring to consciousness, you know, your behavior is hurting us as a collective. And in a very, it has to be a very warm table and a very human table. It can never be authoritarian or destructive, or, you know, what brings us together is has to be the essence of that meeting. So we have to be very honest also and very good leaders and honest with ourselves, not doing what we don't want them to do to us. So it's a lot of personal work. It's a lot of collective work. And then it gets to a point where it's natural. When somebody behaves out of order, it's so obvious, you know, that even that person either leaves the group forever, which has not happened that much in our lives, but it had happened, or that person changes behavior to be part of the group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that's something that we talk about all the time with designing a winning environment, is where when you have a great environment, then people adapt to that environment. So once you create it and you have caring people that are co-creating the environment together, when people come into that environment, they immediately see and know how people are engaging with each other, and they just adapt to it very quickly.
Yeah. And the other part of that piece, Dave, is that, and it's something that I had to work a lot with community leaders and with principals, is that you never let things grow. You have to take things when they happen. You know, sometimes people say, oh, don't worry, next time she won't interrupt in the meeting. When some people begin to have a behavior that is very outside of the culture, you should intervene immediately in a very warm way. But, you know, the behavior of the adults is something you cannot let grow. If it grows, then it's very hard, and it can make a lot of harm. So it's something to bring to consciousness and to be aware of. It is not something, you know, many times people think that that's not important, that the important things are the decisions and the issues and if the school was open or not. That's important. That's the goal. That's the dream. But the other piece that is going to hold that dream together for a long time is the community, the relationships. That's where autonomy and where change happens, when people are strong together, you know. So you have to take care of the soul of your group as much as you have to take care of the issues, of the political issues, of the economic issues. The soul of the groups are very important to take care of. And it's an exercise, and it's very concrete, you know, and there's some things you can do and some things that are not permitted in this place.
Gotcha. Great. Patricia, that was a great question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for such a wonderful answer. Thank you.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Thank you.
Coach Molly, did you want to ask something or add something?
Well, my question, and this just may be something to follow up with later, but I was just curious around the participants and what ultimately people of the roundtable come to truly love about the experience. What are some of their favorite takeaways?
Oh, yes, Molly, that's something that we cherish, and we have, usually we end the year of work or the semester with a long evaluation, and people have the chance to share. What do people like, and what do people take out of the? First of all, people like very much to be part of something, and to be part of something larger than their own individual agendas. That is something that people cherish very much. People appreciate and thank a human setting, a workplace, an organization that where they feel secure. They many times mention that they feel secure. They feel sure that nobody's going to hurt them, and nobody's going to make fun of them, or nobody's going to lie to them or to talk about them. So they feel safe as human beings. People cherish the fact that they have a safe place where they can think, and they can change their thinking, and that's fine. So they can work their ideas through and their processes through. Another thing that they cherish is the strong relationships that develop in a healthy group. People become a friend in the work. And friends in a very healthy way, you know. I'm not talking about friends that hang out on Fridays or go out, or maybe they do, but that's not the essence of their friendship. It's something bigger unites them, and they feel when life, you know, gives them times of trouble, there are a lot of people around them that really care and are there with them. So it's like a family, a big family. And in a very broken society that is very cherished, people have very few places where they have community, a real community. So people appreciate that very much. And in the concrete work we do, teachers cherish very much the fact that they can make their classrooms peaceful places, and they don't have to deal with so much violence in their everyday lives like they used to do before. That is something they appreciate and they celebrate all the time. That the school settings that were violent and were very nasty places have become a more, you know, joyful place to go and to celebrate life and to, you know, treat each other well. And so those are the things that we keep bringing up, you know. One thing that people, and I was in a community meeting yesterday, that really, you know, touched me last night when the parents were saying that one of the best things that happened to them through this process is that they rescue their faith in the fact that things can be different and the possibility. And they said, we had a dream 3 years ago, and now we have a school, a very good school for our children. So that element of faith, because something concrete is happening and, you know, things can change. And that's very strong for me. That's very, you know, that made me really happy last night.
Yes. You are restoring people's faith in humanity.
Yes, yes, yes. In themselves, in their children. You know, one of the mothers was saying, now I think that my child is going to make it. You know, that's very strong. That's very strong. And not feel that people are judging her, or, you know, people, you know, cherish the fact that she's struggling and she's there with her kids, you know, and she all of a sudden saw there's a possibility. My child is going to be fine. He's going to be, you know, whatever he wants to be. And that's very strong for us.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. Molly, great, great question. Thank you for inspiring Dr. Anna to share these things with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
All right. Well, we have gone over time in this game, so hopefully it was worthwhile. I feel blessed to have been a part of this conversation. You've given, I can just tell you that the Coachville staff chat board has more comments on it than any other session we've ever had. So this is a pretty exciting meeting for us, so we're very grateful. To you, Dr. Anna, and to all of you who participated with us today. And we look forward to having you all be a part of the whole process of bringing these engaged superpowers into your world, your community, and to make the world better for all of those of us who are playing on the humanity flourishing team. So we're very grateful to all of you. So we want to conclude this conversation and also remind everyone we will have our last superpower gathering for this part of the event. It will be on Friday at 11. Is that correct, Molly? I think it is. Molly, are you there?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
So Friday at 11, okay. No worries. So Friday at 11, so we will look forward to having you back with us then. We'll have the amazing Jay will be with us, and so we'll be looking forward to that. And I guess that's it for right now. I want to thank you all. We'll turn on the mic so we can say goodbye to each other. Have a wonderful day. Dr. Anna, thank you again so much for sharing your wisdom with us. We're very grateful.
Thank you. An honor being with you. Thank you.
All right. There we go. All right. The mics are on. Have a great week, everyone. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.